which is the curvature perturbation, and then we'll derive, remind you what the scale, well, remind you, derive the spectral index. And these are two things which are directly constrained by observations. So I'll show you explicitly saying chaotic inflation, how do you calculate these things, and then at the end I'd like to just introduce very quickly the Sachs-Wolfe effect, which is the most simple, basic, physical way to see how these curvature perturbation can lead to temperature fluctuation in the CMB. So I remind you that lambda CDM needs three things that inflation is supposed to provide from the initial condition point of view. We need a set of initial conditions which is scale invariant, which is Gaussian, and which is frozen on super horizon scales. This was what I started with in the first lecture, reminding you that this is what we, for observation, we see that we need a mechanism to generate these. So today I want to remind you exactly where these come from. But first, also, I got some questions which I can answer through the questions through the review process. So, and some of them are very good questions. So let me, well, they're all good questions. So let me answer them. One of the questions was about a scalar field model and how they could be such an effective model for so many phenomena. And there's another very related question is which was why do we use at all a scalar field model for doing inflation? And the question was whether we could use stuff that we know about, like more like matter or radiation. So let me answer those two questions together. First, I always like to say that we have seen scalar fields. Okay, often people like to think that scalar fields are something that is weird, because when you write the standard model, particle content, you have only fermions and bosons, vector bosons, and so hey, there's no scalar field. This is a somewhat very narrow point of view. Okay, we've seen scalar fields all over. This is a scalar field. Okay, this is a scalar curvature perturbation. This is in the metric. This is not made of fermions. This is not a Cooper pair. This is not an effective. This, as far as we know, it's fundamental. It's the metric. It's a scalar field. It's been detected. We see scalar perturbations. Now, normally you say, well, oh, gravity should only have gravitational waves. Well, that's only true if you expand around a flat background or with some very special isometries. Here, we're expanding around a time-dependent background. So we broke time diffeomorphism, and so we got a scalar field. There's 3 degrees of freedom now in the metric, not 2. Okay. So this is a scalar field, and there's tons of scalar field all over. Some of them are not fundamental scalar fields, that we know that. Like, and superconductor, the theory of superconductors, you also effectively, it's a scalar field. But there we know that it's really a Cooper pair. So it's two fermions pairing together, giving you an effective scalar. Another scalar field is if you want to describe water or any fluid, to a good approximation, you can use a scalar field to describe them. Again, we know that this is not fundamental. If you look, you know, small enough, you'll see that there's molecular structure to water. You know, it's made of atoms, and so it's not really a scalar. Same with temperature. Temperature is a very good scalar field, but that one is not fundamental. But being fundamental or not is not really important. Scalar fields are all over, okay? And in some cases, we don't even know. We're not saying that this guy is made of fermions or made of atoms. You know, this is space-time. So this is as fundamental as it can be. And so scalar fields are all over, so somewhat natural to use them. The reason in particular it's important to use them in inflation is that scalar fields are the only thing that's going to give you this scalar and tensors, but really what we want is, I mean, we want to create the scalar curvature perturbation. This is what we detect. And we want to have large fluctuation, classical. So fermions won't do it because you have the Pauli exclusion principle. You cannot, essentially we need to create some kind of Bose-Einstein condensate. We need to stack up a lot of bosons together. So that's why we need a scalar. Fermions won't do it. Gauge field could, maybe. Some models out there are trying to make inflation with vectors. But they tend to break anisotropy. They tend to have a preferred direction. They are not really scale invariant unless you fine-tune them a lot. So scalar is the best thing to do for inflation. It's just that's what naturally comes out. Okay? That was one of the questions. Two of the questions. Another one was whether we can, how are we trying to measure the Unruh effect? And that, I hope I didn't convey the wrong impression. Actually, I don't think of anybody who's really trying. It's really hard. Back the theorists are doing back of the envelope calculation, trying to figure out if we could test it. And there are some maybe analog system. So there are like kind of, you know, door in the back or back door way of trying to test it. But technically, really, I don't think there's any experiments. There's no experimentalists really trying to detect a group experimentation, because back of the envelope calculation is we don't have any idea of really how to do it. But I'm sure that some other people will say, well, there's, you know, there might be some caveats here, but it's like Hawking radiation. If we detect it, it's going to be very indirect at first. And finally, last question was about that I can answer. There was more questions, but I'll leave some to Matt in the next second part of the class. But a question was about the stability of massive monopoles. And why do we have monopole problems? Why are monopoles stable? Well, that's simple. Well, why is anything stable that's massive? The only way you can make something massive stable is by giving it a charge. Okay. If you have anything that, you know, why is dark matter stable? Anybody knows why the WIMP, the weakly interacting? It's not supersymmetry. Supersymmetry does not make the WIMP stable. Why is dark matter, a very massive particle, not decaying to electron all the time?
You mean R symmetry?
Yeah, you need R symmetry. You need a symmetry. You need a specific symmetry. You need to say the dark matter has a R charge, which technically is not something that supersymmetry requires. So it's something in addition to supersymmetry, although many supersymmetric models does do it naturally. But you need to give the dark matter, says the dark matter has R charge 1, and all the standard model does not have R charge, or R charge 0, or R charge, different R charge. So then you cannot decay. Well, the monopoles has a magnetic charge. So that's why it's an obvious thing that if it's there in the, we don't have, nothing in the standard model has magnetic charge. So if there is a magnetic monopole out there, it's not going to be able to decay to us because of charge conservation. So that's the only trick how you can make these massive relics stable, is by giving them some charge and just assume that everybody else that's lower mass does not have that charge, or assumed, or measure it to be a fact. Right, so these were all great questions. Any other great questions? Or normal questions? Right, so let's go to the quickly. So unfortunately, I'm somewhat following the syllabus right on time, but I'm running a little behind, so I won't do much of the CMB, but hopefully give you the most basic fact where Sackwolf, which is relatively simple to see. Okay, so last time we used ADM, formalism, to expand the action for slow roll inflation plus Einstein's gravity, 2-second order, in the curvature perturbation. So this is S2 here means 2-second order. We expand it to 2-second order. And then the solution to this, well, we can canonically normalize this again, define a chi k, which has a mode vk. And so this is going to be just like in a Disseter space, because there's no mass term. So this has a 1 over k 3 half eta. And let me write all of this in the, always work in the k eta, much less in one limit, so I'm only looking at super horizon modes. And then this is the canonically normalized field. To go back to the normal, to the actual curvature perturbation, we just put this factor back in here. And to first order, assuming epsilon is constant, or nearly constant, so in slow roll expansion, this gives you a mode uk, which is just h over k to the 3 half, epsilon times M Planck. Okay. And the square root of 2, actually. Square root of 2 is because usually this guy has a 1 half and here it doesn't. Right. And the idea is that this guy, as I argued last time, is constant outside the horizon. Okay. For k eta much less than 1, this guy does not vary. Okay. You look at the equation for zeta, it's essentially not varying outside the horizon. So this should be evaluated at horizon crossing. And then it's going to stay constant until then. Now, importantly, when you evaluate this at this value, don't put k. This what it means is this is a function. These two guys are function of times, h and epsilon. Evaluate them at the time where this is an equation for the time. Okay, so this gives you a time, t star. Okay, so that means that zeta k, when you calculate, say, the 2-point of zeta k, you should evaluate h, say, at t star. So h star, now let's do the 2 points of 2 epsilon star k cube m Planck squared. This is what we did last time, where t equal t star is this, well, t is here. It's this time where you solve this equation for t as a function of k. So there's really that, therefore there's a k dependence hidden in these two guys. Okay? And last time, very quickly, I derived, so you just if you calculate this in real space, you can write this as dk over k times the power spectrum for zeta, which is dk over k of this guy here times a 1/2. Oh, did I forget a 1/2 here again? Sorry. Convention. And so this ends up being 8 pi square epsilon m Planck square h square. Okay, so this is our power spectrum. Any questions about that? So the first thing to note, so this is the curvature perturbation coming from inflation. This guy here is ensuring this part. So this is a solved problem because zeta is constant on superhorizon scale. Okay. So this implies this. Technically, there's another variable you'll see in the literature called r, curly r. It's slightly different from this one. This is the one which is truly conserved. This here we really have to look at superhorizon mode. If you're close to the horizon, this varies a little bit. But if you're only interested in superhorizon mode, there's absolutely no difference really between these two. So zeta is fine. This is a solidity that if I had more time and we wanted to, you can look at it more, but it's not really that important. So zeta is really conserved on superhorizon mode. Okay, sorry for going over here, but now my boards have had time to dry. Questions? All right, so zeta is constant, so that's the first thing. Now let's look quickly at the Gaussianity. Why is this Gaussian? What do we mean by Gaussianity? Well, so what we did when we expanded in zeta, we just kept the second order. There's really a zeroth order. The first order in zeta is zero, so it's second, third. So when we expand the action, we get the background, the kinetic term, then you get cubic and quartic interaction, and so forth. This guy is roughly just a cubed times v of phi. I'm neglecting the integrals here. Here it's going to be order of magnitude. Okay. This is a very hot topic nowadays, and you can get quite deep into it. Let's just do an order of magnitude to check why is it Gaussian. Okay, so the background is roughly just dominated by the potential a cubed v phi, which is roughly just a cubed h square m Planck square. Okay, so now I'm working in a cubed is because I'm working in t, not just FRW term. This guy here, well, we just wrote it down there, but I wrote it in terms of eta, but never mind that. It's a cubed epsilon m Planck square zeta dot square minus 1 over a square. Okay, I'm running the same thing, just switching from conformal time to FRW time. And then the cubic, after a lot of work, you can show that the dominant term, this is in the Malacena paper, there's actually one single dominant term, which goes like, actually, sorry, a to the 5 m Planck times h zeta dot square derivative minus 2 zeta dot. Remember these weird non-local operator? That's because we fixed the gauge, and then the action looks non-local. So this is 1 del minus 2 is really the Laplacian square. All right. Let's just get a magnitude estimate of what these terms are. Okay, so this one we already know that's the size. What are these guys? Well, what we're saying when we solve this here, what we're saying here is that zeta fluctuates with of order. The fluctuations of zeta is of order h or epsilon m Planck. Okay. Let's forget about the k cube and the factors for the moment. So this is just roughly the size and magnitude for a given k-mode. And that's supposed to happen over time of order 1 over Hubble. And space, delta x, 1 over a Hubble, because this is co-moving coordinates. Okay? So that's just to get the order of the size of the operator in this Lagrangian. Okay? So that means derivative with respect to time goes like h. And derivative with respect to x times 1 over a goes like h again. This is roughly what's happening, is that I'm getting large fluctuations of this order over this time scale and this distances. This is how the field is fluctuating. Remember that the field phi, the scalar itself, has fluctuation of order h. This one has a fluctuation of order h over m Planck, first of all, because this is dimensionless. It's a metric. And also it has a 1 over epsilon. So that means actually curvature perturbations are bigger than scalar, normal, just scalar perturbations because of that epsilon, which is less than 1.
Is it a square root of the epsilon?
I'm sorry, what?
Is it because you just took the square root of a?
That's right. I just took the square root of this.
Okay, because you have epsilon there and also epsilon there.
Oh, yeah, sorry, square root. Thank you. I just took the square root, but I didn't. Took it right. Okay. Yeah, that's important. So sanin la la. Okay, good. So then if you just plug that in here, whenever you have a time derivative, that's of order h. Whenever you have a space derivative over a, it's of order h. And zeta is supposed to be of this order. Then you find that this term here is really of order a cubed h4. Both terms are the same order. And a cubed h4. So I'm just estimating the size of the terms of the Lagrangian. And then this one, if you do the same thing, derivatives, replace, blah, 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 you get it's a cube epsilon to the 1 half h to the 5 over m. Okay? So then we can check. We got this answer here by forgetting about this. We assume the system was perturbative. We says, let's forget the cubic. Let's solve just using the quadratic, and that's the answer. Now we can check whether we did a correct approximation, where we write to neglect this term, just by doing this order of magnitude estimate. Well, you see that if you're in a regime where epsilon is less than 1, and if h is less than m Planck, then you have the following hierarchy that s0 is bigger than s2, which is bigger than s3, and you can show this goes on to higher order. So the fluctuations are smaller than the background. Makes sense. It's good. And the cubic term is smaller than the quadratic, so the system is perturbative. Because epsilon here is smaller than 1, and h over m Planck is smaller than 1. Okay. And so that means that zeta is almost a free field. Okay. Interactions are small. Okay, that means that the two-point fully specify or approximately is good enough okay, to determine the whole thing, which is saying that this is going to be Gaussian-type perturbations. And so that means that we have explained this guy here. Gaussianity. This actually is a hot topic nowadays because the slow model is probably too Gaussian. This is actually turns out to be really small. And there's many ways to see how they could be once you couple the inflaton, say, to the standard model, or when you include more fields, or when you do what when more general or more realistic model of inflations would usually make these terms bigger. And some of these more realistic model of inflation are ruled out because they produce too much non-Gaussianity, and we haven't seen it. So this is a very interesting topic. There's a lot of research going on right now trying to measure deviation from Gaussianity. In other words, people are trying, they look at the CMB and they're trying to measure zeta cubed, say, the three-point function. Right now, we haven't detected this. this is zero, as far as we can tell. But there's hopes that we could eventually, with the new satellites and new data, there's hope that we could figure that out. If we do, we're going to learn a lot more about inflation, because once we start measuring this, we're starting measuring interactions. This is part of the problem with inflation right now, though. It's a great theory, but the only thing we're seeing from it, it's the free field part. This is very limited information. It's like if you're trying to learn the standard model by just looking at the kinetic terms. Nothing is allowed to decay into nothing else. You're just seeing how every field is normalized. You know, that's not enough. That's not a lot of information. So this is what we're saying. We know we just see how the kinetic term. We don't see anything else. We don't see what the inflaton decays into or whatnot. So that's a bit unfortunate, but still, I mean, at least the kinetic term is working perfectly, and we really agree with data. All right. So that's Gaussianity. Last one is scale invariance. Well, the idea is that P zeta, so we have the idea is this guy essentially is nearly constant. And so this is what we mean by scale invariant. This is a constant. So that means there's roughly. So there's essentially the same power per logarithmic interval in K. Okay. But it's not actually exactly constant, right? Because it depends on time. Square, epsilon star, m Planck square. So these guys depend on time a little bit. And so what's the expectation? So draw our diagram again of physical scale. So this is 1 over h, say, and like this. So I have a mode here that exits at time t1. And I have another one that exits at time t2. So the idea is that these two different time, h will have changed a little bit, and epsilon will have changed a little bit. So this guy would change. Okay, so this is a physical scale. And time. So what's the expectation? Well, we expect that as time moves forward, goes to plus infinity, we expect h to decrease, at least during inflation. Actually all the time. We always expect h to decrease. Again, I mentioned quickly last time, this is almost guaranteed if you respect the null energy condition, that h is going to decrease. Just conservation of energy. Some kind of conservation of energy, the null energy condition, almost guarantee that this guy should go down. But epsilon, on the other hand, really can go either way. It could increase or it could decrease. It can go either way. But it's very typical. Very typical that epsilon increases as you move forward. The reason is because epsilon measures the flatness of the potential. So as you move in time, the potential should get steeper and steeper. And then eventually epsilon should get of order 1 and inflation should net. Usually epsilon increases. So that's typical, but it's not. This is not always. This is just sometimes, most of the time, or many models. Okay. So when you put these two things, you see what happens is that as you move forward in time, h decrease and epsilon increase. These goes both ways in the same direction. So as t goes to future, we find that in general, most model, many models. P zeta, so decrease. Okay. A little bit. Not nearly constant, but it's decreasing. And what does that mean? So if the power is smaller at later time, remember, first to leave, last to arrive. So later times means smaller scale. And earlier times means larger scale. Larger universe, smaller universe. So that means that many models predict that there should be more power on large scale. Okay. So this is this corresponds to what I'll define a bit, but this is called a red tilt. So the idea is if I look at the power spectrum, and let's put the scales here. So this is, let's say, you usually put large scale here. This is how you see the CMB, large scales and small scales. So if it was exactly scale invariant, it would be a constant. But now, most of the time, there's a red tilt. So this is a red tilt. We have evidence, three sigma evidence, that the power spectrum from inflation has a red tilt. And so many models are doing good. the red tilt that we measure, I'll give you in a second. So we see that it's not exactly scale invariant. There's a red tilt. This is vastly exaggerated. It's not that, you know, but there's a small slope. OK? Right, actually, let me define. So we actually define this using just ns minus 1, which is defined as the derivative with respect to log k of the log of p zeta. Okay. And p zeta is just, you're just taking derivative of h and derivative of epsilon, both of which will give us, derivative of h gives us epsilon, and derivative of epsilon gives you eta, the Searle parameter. Right. So you can just work this out. Not very little algebra, you can find that this, in general, just from the definition in Searle, our Searle parameter, is equal to this. Or if you write it in terms of my previous definition. Okay, so these are the epsilon parameters that I defined before, and this the Searle parameters, and then this is the vector, the potential, epsilon v plus eta v. Okay, so this is, so you see that if the Searle parameters are small, ns minus 1 is going to be small, and ns equal 1 corresponds to scale invariant. That means that this is truly a constant. This is 0. So this is truly a constant by logarithmic interval. So this is scale invariant. And if ns is less than 1, this is a red tilt or a red spectrum. And if ns is greater than 1, this is a blue spectrum. Technically, both have been possible in the data. But right now, the data suggests that it's red. Questions on this stuff?
So, well, I didn't completely understand. So when you derive with respect to log of k, if, for example, in h, I would think that it only depends on t. So how can you get this parameter?
Right, so remember that this is evaluated at k equal ah. So there is a time. So d log k is a d log of a. And this is roughly h d star. Because a is e to the h. This guy is e to the h d star. So this is evaluated at horizon crossing. Horizon crossing is a time, t star, which depends on what the mode is. Different modes k leave at different times. Okay, so there's through the time dependence, you get a k dependence. Okay. So this is how you d log k means dt stars, and then you take derivative with respect to t of h, you get an epsilon down, and you take derivative of epsilon, you get an eta. And then you just good question. Other questions? All right, let's do, so the data suggests, the data measure two things. So first, I will, in the last probably 15 minutes, I'll explain to you why p zeta is roughly the same as delta t over t on large scale. And this is measured to be of order 10 minus 9, or delta t over t squared, sorry. 10 minus 9. Move this up a little bit. Okay. And so this is measured to be 10 over 10 minus 9. And there's factors here. And I'll try to derive quickly the factors, at least on large scales. There's a lot of physics, in fact. There's a lot of physics going on here. But it turns out that on large scale, it's essentially they're proportional to each other, up to numerical factors. And the other thing that we measure, and I don't remember the error bars on any of these two, but it's a spectral index, and it's 0.96. So that's the center value. And I think it's 0.0, 0.025, the uncertainty? I don't remember. So it's a red, seems to be red. Okay, so let me just quickly move to part two, chaotic inflation. So we started chaotic inflation last time. We just required that was number of equal was 60. Now let's demand that this model agrees with the data. Okay. Well, it's pretty simple because there's only, we already calculated last time. So chaotic inflation, to remind you, this is this m squared phi squared potential. I start here. And we measured that epsilon, we derived last time that epsilon parameter was m Planck square over phi square, which is the same as the 1 over the number of EFO, it turns out, for this model. So this is for chaotic inflation. This is what I derived in the previous lectures. And it turns out this is essentially roughly the same as eta. Well, I think it's very much the same as eta. Okay. So then you can just go ahead and plug it in, because we know also what h is. But let's not, yeah. So let's plug it in. So p zeta is h squared and Planck square over, so 1 over 8 pi square, and then 1 over epsilon, which is number of e-folds. So it's just number of e-fold here for this model. This is roughly, so the scale that we see at CMB, for the k we need, this is roughly, again, 50 or 60. The number of e-folds is like 50 to 60 or something. So if you divide by 8 pi squared, this is some number of order 1. Okay. And so, and then the idea that this should be of order 10 minus 9 if we want to match the data. There's factors going on everywhere here, but I just want to get the order of magnitude. So what we learned from this is that in this type of model, h, the Hubble scale, should be almost of order 10 minus 5 in Planck. 10 to minus 4.5, but, you know, factors. So this is, we need, in order to get that, we need this. So this is a constraint on chaotic inflation. This means the scale of inflation is very high. Almost, you know, it's, M Planck is 10 to the 18 GeV, so, or 10 to the 19 even. So this is roughly gut scale, a little lower than gut grand unified theory scale, 10 to the very high scale. Nothing we've seen in the lab, nothing. So it's very high scale inflation. So this is specific to this model, but this is a kind of number you often get when you want to match the data. You find that h has to be lower than Planck scale, but not so low. So it's pretty high. So doing this, you can fix, and I haven't done the number, but there's only one parameter in this theory, it's m. So that fixes m. Then you have zero freedom, so it's a nice model. Then you can see what does it predict for ns minus 1. So what is ns minus 1 for this model? Well, this model has, it's just, so I can write it, say, in terms of epsilon b. Yeah, here I should say this is epsilon b. Yeah, sorry. So ns minus 1 in terms of epsilon b is what? Minus 6 epsilon b plus 2 eta v, which, since these two guys are equal and this is equal to epsilon b almost always, then this is just minus 4 epsilon v, which is minus 4 over the number of e fold. Okay, and this guy is totally independent of the mass. It's just fixed for this type of model. And if the number of e fold is around 50 or 60, you'll find this is around 0.93 or 0.94, and so forth. Okay. So it's red. It's actually a little too red, but it's actually not very ruled out by the data. But m squared phi squared is still. There's another thing also you did a little bit yesterday in the tutorial. You did the tensor. That's another thing scalar to tensor ratio. That's another thing we have data about. And it turns out chaotic inflation, if you look at the WMAP paper, which I invite you to look in the homework at the end of this week, just looked at one plot in the WMAP paper where they put the constraint on NS and on R. And you can see that they put the chaotic inflation there. And you can tell whether you think it's ruled out or not, depending on how many sigmas you decide something is ruled out or not. OK? All right. Any questions? So you can do many, many other models. There are many different V of phi you can choose. They give different predictions for the power spectrum and for the scale. You can also go on and take the derivative of this guy. There's a running of the running. This is called the running of the power spectrum, the spectral index. It's also called the running. There's a running of the running. So there's, you can take the derivative of this with respect to log k. And we try to measure this too. There's a somewhat limited information we can do with the 2-point. So at some point, we have to go to higher statistics, like 3 points and so forth.
So you have a minus sign. How can you get something positive?
No, it's negative. This is negative. But what I meant to say here is ns minus 1 is this. So ns is 0.92. So it's 1 minus this number.
OK, so there it's ns as well.
Yes. So ns close to 1, so ns minus 1 should be close to 0. Good. All right, so now let's go through this, going from pz to delta t over t. Now, it turns out that zeta is actually not a very good gauge. The zeta gauge is not very good to do, it's not very good to do real CMV physics. And the reason is because you put everything in the metric. And that can cause trouble because then you can have like black hole or, you know, sometimes the matter density perturbations are huge. Like we live on a planet right now, the matter density is like a huge number. It's much bigger than 10 to the minus 5. If you put it in the metric, you're mixing a small metric perturbation to potentially huge matter perturbations. So it gets really messy to use zeta gauge. So to do CMB physics, it's better to change gauge. So let me show you a bit how you go about changing gauges. There are variables called Bardeen variables, but I'm not going to do it that way. There are Bardeen variables, which are choices of scalars in the metric, which are gauge invariant. And most people, when they change gauge, what they do is they go and they calculate the Bardeen variable and go forth. But really, you can just change gauge by doing a time diff always. So let me summarize the gauges that are popular in cosmology. Gauges, I'll write the metric, the t mu nu, delta t mu nu. Then what's good about it and what's bad about it. The gauge is always good and bad. There's no gauge out there, which is always good. So all right, co-moving gauge is the one we've discussed up to now. The metric is ADM, so it has a lapse and a shift. And then the tree metric is a square 1 plus 2 zeta. Delta mu nu is 0 in this case. And the good is that zeta is conserved. So it's the good variable to see that it's conserved when kata is much less than 1. And the bad is it's really messy to use. Nobody uses it. Really messy to use. And the standard Big Bang. And the radiation and matter domination.
Are you supposing that we don't have curvature fluctuations? Well, the tensor fluctuations are.
Yeah, that's right. Let's put all the tensors to 0. Let's just look at the scalar sector. Other questions? So another good one is a spatially flat gauge. It's good during inflation. It's not really ever used. Then it's the same. It's ADM again, but this time hij is flat. And then I have a, if I'm doing inflation, I would have a delta phi perturbation. Okay, so let me try to divide these guys here. And that one is intuitive to do inflation. Is going to be essentially the gauge, or you can do eternal inflation, blah, blah, blah. And I think this is probably what Matt's going to be using most of the time, just work with delta phi. But the problem is delta phi is not conserved. So that's why we didn't use this to derive the perturbation. And in fact, not only is it not conserved, the amphiton presumably disappears completely at the end of the day. You have inflation, at the end of the day, after inflation is done, we don't see the amphiton. The scalar field is not here. So you don't want to keep track of the perturbation in that field. That's like he's not even there anymore. So versus the metric stays there. So if you have a metric perturbation, a curvature perturbation, then it during inflation, and we see it today as a metric perturbation. The one that cosmologists use is there's a different one. It's conformal Newtonian gauge. In that gauge, the metric has the following form. And then they will be general. Now let's say, let's not suppose it's just a scalar field. They will be general delta t mu. There's one scalar here. I'm not writing here the most general form. This is you can find it in books, and it's not important for today. Okay, so here I have capital phi and capital psi. Okay. These are my two gauge. Two here, and then another one here. Note that everywhere I have three scalars. One, two, three scalars. Here I have the shift delta phi, and here I have one, two, three. Okay, I'm going to use a constraint to eliminate two, so at the end of the day, you always only have one, but at this point, I'm just fixing the gauge, so here I have three scalars, here I have three scalars, and here I have three scalars, phi, psi, and whatever delta here ends up being, which I don't have time to go through. So the reason why this case is good, so this is intuitive for inflation. This is intuitive for the rest of physics. This is for the rest of physics, really, because that's the gauge which reduces to the Newtonian limits. With this gauge, I'll be able to tell you exactly what's happening with the photon, because really you'll see that this is just a gravitational potential stretching the time direction, if you want. This is just stretching the space direction. This is where like the Newton's equation comes out naturally. So it's just good. It's just where it's the one that's the most intuitive if you're doing like normal Newtonian physics kind of thing. The reason it's bad, well, again, for inflation, there are many other reasons maybe, but phi is not conserved, again. So that's why I didn't use it to start with. It's also a bit messy if you want to calculate, for example, the cubic term. But then also this one is also messy, so I guess that's not really good reason. And finally, there's another one which I'm not going to write, but just going to tell you about. It's called synchronous gauge, which actually turns out that one was the most popular one in the early days of standard Big Bang cosmology, but nowadays we don't really use it much. Let me not write it for you, we won't need it. You can find it in books, just a rearrangement again of the metric. And the synchronous gauge is good for numerical computation. This is why it's used nowadays, numerical computation. So there's a program that calculates the CMB acoustic peaks and everything. They use the numerical computations, they use a synchronous gauge. It just turns out to be better numerically. And bad for many reasons otherwise. Led to many mistakes, actually. It's a very interesting history. Because the synchronous gauge is one of those gauges which actually is not completely fixed. So there's some remaining gauge degree of freedom, and people were not appreciating this. So sometimes they were discovering some grandiose thing. But it turned out to be all a gauge artifact because they hadn't fixed the gauge completely. So, but once you know about it, it's still a very useful way to write a metric, and you can do good stuff. So how do you go from one gauge to the next? So these are the the most popular gauges. Let's go between co-moving to spatially flat. That's like one line. Co-moving gauge to spatially flat. During inflation, where T mu nu is a scalar field. So that's my only assumption. Okay. So what do you do? Well, in co-moving, hij is just, so the scale factor e to the 2ht plus 2 zeta times delta ij. Neglecting tensor. So what I did here is I just exponentiated the zeta because it's small, I can do that. Assuming it's small, I can do that. And in spatially flat, hij is just e to the 2ht. And here I have delta phi equals 0. So I have phi exactly equal to phi of t. Well, here I have phi equal to phi of t. Let me write this. This is a new. Let me write this. This is a new coordinate system. Phi of t delta phi. All right. So I want to do a gauge transformation that goes from here to here. It's pretty simple, right? I just need to change my time coordinate. Okay, just define a new t tilde is going to be has to be equal to, well, that's right. It's going to have to be the original t. Then it's going to have to be minus zeta over, well, there's a 2 here, over h. So if you put, if you replace here t, probably should be a plus. I replace t tilde. So put a plus here, then so replace t here, and then you'll see that you'll get that. You know, you're just canceling. So this is what I said before. Zeta is just a shift in time, so I can just redefine a new time, and then zeta is gone. But when I do this. This phi here is a function of t. I can expand it. It's going to be a phi tilde plus a correction. Then this correction is just going to be what? It's just going to be phi dot times then this guy here. And since it's on the other side, you get a minus sign. So it's minus 1 over h times zeta. Okay, so I just Taylor expanded. Phi of t, replace t by t tilde minus this, Taylor expand for small zeta. So you find that you can switch between the two gauge, and you can relate this here to be minus h over phi dot delta phi. This is actually quite an important relationship to remember. So what's happening is a fluctuation in delta phi generates a fluctuation in curvature perturbation, and the way to go from one to the other is to multiply by h over phi. Okay. It's an important relationship because tomorrow I think you'll see that the quantum versus classical here is pretty obvious. Okay, 1105. All right, but delta phi is still a bad gauge to do CMB, so I need to go to Newtonian. And that would be nice or to keep. Let me go back up here. Sorry. But any questions? Oh, have you copied this? I'm doomed. All right, let me erase something. I won't need it. Okay, so let's now go from co-moving to Newtonian gauge or conformal Newtonian gauge, and let's assume now that T mu nu is not just a scale factor. T mu nu is a perfect fluid. Rho, this is what we need for doing CMB, and it has some equation of state omega. Okay, so I remind you that P is omega rho. So this is rho, this is PPB. All right, so I'm not going to go, this is a little bit more complicated, but if you want, I can show you. It's still it's one page, it's not, you know, a couple of lines. It's just a time diffeomorphism. Just do a time, just do a change of coordinates in time, and then you can take the co-moving gauge to the Newtonian gauge. And what and when you do that, you're going to have to expand these guys, so you're going to get rho becomes, say, rho dot, since you're only doing the time diff, you're only changing this guy, the T00. So when you do your time diffeomorphism, T is a function of T tilde is a function of T, then T, then rho will go to rho plus rho dot times something, some small parameter. And then rho dot, you can use the continuity equation to write in terms of rho plus P. That's essentially the steps. Okay. Then when you do that, turns out you can write the whole solution in terms of just so minus psi, minus 2 or plus, no, that's minus 2, 3 times 1 plus omega phi. So that's the relation between the curvature zeta and the psi and phi. Now, again, why do I have two guys here? Well, you can use a constraint. There's two fields there. Really, at the end of the day, there should be only one. You can use a constraint. And in the Newtonian gauge, if you don't have any vector perturbation, so there's a little bit of assumptions here, but not very many, it turns out that very often phi is equal to psi once you use the constraint. These two guys end up being exactly equal. So the end answer is the relation between phi, the Newtonian potential, and zeta is minus phi, 5 plus 3 omega to 3 plus 3 omega. And now you see something important. As zeta is conserved, you can tell why phi is not conserved. Yeah, Sachs-Wolfe effect is going to be. So zeta is conserved here. And so let's say you're going, you start in the radiation era. And then you go to matter. Okay. So this is going to be time of equality, and this is time of recombination. This is where the CMB last scatter. Well, when omega is 1/3, this guy ends up being so. Let me write it this way. So let me write it for phi. So phi is equal to minus 2/3 zeta in the radiation when omega is 1/3, and it's equal to minus 3/5 zeta in the matter era when omega is 0. And so phi here, let's do the magnitude of phi because it has a sign difference, that doesn't matter. So it starts, it's 2/3 of this guy, so it's 2/3. And then at time equality, it drops to 1/2, roughly 3/5. Okay, so zeta here is constant. But phi changes, and it changes in a step-like fashion when w changes in a step-like fashion. It changes like omega changes, the equation of state. So phi is not conserved. But that's fine. Again, we know how it varies. So it goes from being 2/3 of the original thing to being 3/5. So just a gauge summation tells us the relation between them. All right, so now that we have phi, I can do Sachs-Wolfe. In 5 minutes, you'll see. Sachs-Wolfe is easy. But questions? Sorry, I'm going fast. All good. So okay, so we have perturbations in the gravitational potential phi. And those re-enter the horizon, and then what happens is they see a universe filled with radiation and matter, and this radiation and matter will seize the space-time curvature, and so they react. So essentially, you know, there's a plasma at the beginning of radiation, and the plasma sees this curvature perturbation, and if there's enough time, they'll just fall in, And the effect is to induce plasma oscillation. This is where the acoustic peaks come from. And this is a bit messy to do carefully. But if you look at large scale enough, so look at the thing that, if you look at only at the scale around time of recombination. So let's just look at the scale K, which enters around recombination time, a little bit before, a little bit after, around recombination time. Then the plasma won't have much time to react very much. The perturbation enters, and then the photon don't really, there's no oscillation, there's no weird thing that's going to be going on. It's not really weird oscillations, but there's no somewhat complicated physics. It's just, it's just going to be, because the universe is going to become very soon transparent, and then the photon are going to stream right to us, recombination here. Still, there is an effect here, and there's two effects. So let's say you enter around recombination time. So first, that means we're in the matter era. Because recombination time, remember, is always after equality time. It's always after. So we're in the matter era, which means that phi is minus 3/5 zeta. And then there's two effects. First of all, the first effect is that a psi perturbation in the metric. So I have 1 plus or 1 minus psi. The sign is actually important, minus 2 psi, dx squared. So this is the spatial part of the metric in the Newtonian gauge. There's a psi here. So the psi, what does the psi does? Well, it's just shifting the space a little bit. It's making, what it does is just like changing the length of a meter by a small 2 psi amount. Okay. What does that mean? That means that if I look at the wavelength of a photon, then the delta lambda over lambda for that photon is going to be roughly order minus psi. Okay. So the small perturbation of the metric is going to directly change the wavelength of the photon at CMB scale.
What do you mean with the delta lambda? So from before until it gets a perturbation?
That's right. So take it's the lambda perturbed minus lambda average divided by lambda average. And the reason why you need to take a ratio is this is dimensionless. So this should be, a ratio. So this induces a change in the wavelength, and then you need to do a dimensionless number out of it. So it's lambda perturbed minus lambda average divided by lambda average. The average of the metric is, these guys all have average zero. Psi and phi, they don't have any average. The metric on average is FRW, unperturbed. Okay, so phi, the average of phi is we call the average of psi since they're equal and it's zero. So on average, the photons have some wavelength when they recombine, and then there will be a small perturbation proportional to psi. The other effect is that, so that was psi. The other effect is coming from phi, and it's the fact that we're shifting time. So this is a shift in time. Okay, sorry, I'm going to go a little bit over, but not much. So shift in time. So now, how does that work? Well, we know that phi induce a delta t over t, a shift in time, delta t over t here induced by phi, capital phi. Well, we know that at during the matter era, the scale factor is going like t to the 2/3. So during matter. So delta A over A is 2/3 delta T over T. Okay. And then finally, if the temperature goes always like 1 over A, and you should have seen this with Leighton in this universe, and so a delta T, so a change in the scale factor will change the temperature. So you find that delta t over t is just minus delta a over a. And so it's minus 2/3 delta t over t, small t here, which is minus 2/3 phi. Okay, so these are the two effects coming in the sac wolf. You get a shift in distance and a shift in time. Okay, when you add them up, you get 1 minus 2/3, and so you get a 1/3 factor. Let me just quickly, sorry. So putting everything together, we find that delta t over t. Oh, I mean, I didn't say here, but the delta, you know, the temperature of a photon, lambda here. Actually, I should finish this. Sorry. This a change in the frequency, a change in the wavelength is a change in the frequency up to a sine, which is a change in the energy, which is a change in the temperature. Okay, so if I change the frequency of the photon and changing its frequency with a minus sign, because they're invertly related, and that just changes delta t over t. So when you put together everything, you get delta t over t is, and you use the fact that psi is equal to phi, find that delta t over t is 1 minus 2/3 of phi. So this is 1/3 phi, and this is exactly 1/3 of then 3/5 minus 3/5 of zeta. Okay, so we have the relation we wanted. Delta t over t is minus 1/5 zeta. Okay, I hope I get all the factors right, but you see the logic. This is a Sachs-Wolfe effect. It was discovered way before we even invented inflation. The idea is if the universe is not completely homogeneous, small perturbation in the metric will induce perturbation in delta t over t. This is the most basic effect. It's dominant on large scale, but there's a lot more going on in CMB. So there's an optional reading if you want to know this class, which is the review by Hu and Dullison, which is very nice, just goes about the physics. But you see that roughly up to factor of order 1, the thing we calculated during inflation is exactly what we see. Okay. And again, this is the idea is this is a field in space and time. That of x and t, on average is 0. So the average of the, on average there's no fluctuation. The average temperature is 2.7. But when you, on average is 0, but it has a variance. And the variance of this then should be of order, the same order as the variance of this, which is 10 minus 9. All right, this is Carl finishing on time, or so. Any questions? Sorry if it was a bit fast on the last part. So hopefully, so I'm passing the torch now to Matt. And now the idea is, okay, this is the greatest success. Okay, this little simple relation here is the greatest in the fact that this has all the properties. It has this one too, scan variance. It has all the right properties to generate everything we see. And this is the greatest success, but there's many questions about inflation. And then we'll go back and ask what's going on here, how do you start it? What does it really imply, and so forth. So we'll take a look back at that. Question? Okay.
So, but in relation with the power, with the spectral power, you have some the k-dependent there, right?
Yes, so exactly. So this guy here has some k-dependence. You mean through the horizon crossing business?
That's what through. I mean, because before I was checking that you're right, that it was proportional to the power, to the square root of the power, but you still have k-dependence without the horizon,
to the 1 over k.
Yeah.
Yeah, so delta t over t has also this
okay.
1 over k.
Okay.
So by scale invariant, we always mean per logarithmic interval. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Oh, well.